Okay, let's begin the session on looking forward.
Well,
do you have a perspective? And let's see. Arjandu. Did I mispronounce your name?
Stresses. Arjandu.
Okay. He's going to start us off as a genuine junior faculty member.
Okay. All right, so.
Do we have a note taker?
Yeah, so could I ask for a volunteer, a non-junior person as a note taker so we can speak loudly?
I'll take care of the first one.
Okay, great, thanks. So this is probably true for everyone, but the things I have noticed and the things that worried me going into Carleton, the obvious ones, teaching load, grad students, postdocs, don't have any of those.
What is your teaching load?
Officially two classes at a time, but that's the Carleton two classes, which is we teach 200 minutes a week or whatever, which is, so it's more like three classes by time done counting the number of hours we actually spend in there.
And you're on quarters?
Yeah, and we're on quarters.
So six courses.
Six courses over the year, and so it really depends on how you count it. I know labs count differently in different places, but it's a high load. I mean, it's, you know, I don't have. In a good semester, in a good term, a really, really good term, I might have a day when I decide I can carve that out for research. But usually it's more, that's not, you know, yeah. Maybe if I get really efficient, that, well, once I've done, okay, we won't quite go there yet. So teaching issues, et cetera, the subtler issues are what worry me more, because these are things you know up front going into a small college. The subtler issues are, how do you pick a topic that stays at the forefront of the field or somewhere near the forefront of the field without the army and without the collaborators and without the whole research time scale? How do you work with undergraduates on stuff that they don't know anything about because, after all, they are undergraduates? Time scale issues in other ways. How do you pick a topic that you can let go for a term and come back to and hasn't, the whole field hasn't changed and you can ramp back into it and keep going. How do you convince people at research universities that you're not lying when you say you're doing research? It's just how do you keep connected to the community? Thing I really, 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 really miss is talks. I miss talks like nothing, like nothing else. I'm realizing every single term that physics is a far more social and verbal activity than anyone would have you believe, especially theoretical physics. Equations are fine, but you really learn a lot when you sit down across someone. So what the hell do you actually mean by this thing, rather than what's the solution for this equation? And so how do you live without talks? that should get us started. I'm sure I'll think of some more. I should add that I do appreciate some of the real values of being an undergraduate place. The biggest value I see already is freedom. I have complete freedom. I can work on anything I want, and I don't have to feel guilty about forcing someone to spend 6 years on a topic that won't get them a job, because I won't, you know. And I have complete freedom to switch directions I can turn on a dime for research topics, and no one's life is affected by that. I can, the research pressure is, you know, as long as I publish, they don't care what I publish on, as long as, I love the fact that I spend 100% of my time completely engaged. My 80% teaching, well, there's tenure pressures to keep me engaged, and 20% of the time, or whatever I get for my research, it's my lifeblood, and I get to do it to the fullest of my satisfaction. Unlike perhaps the split I see having been a visiting faculty at research schools, where you resent the 25% of the time in front of the students because that's taking you away from the 75% of the time.
Did you say 80% of the time you're expected to be teaching?
This is what a number I've come up with currently. This is going to shift. I'm just, maybe it's a first year ramp up or first year freedom. I don't know. It shifts. I'm just making up a number, just an approximate number. I know it's closer towards this side than that side. But that's all I know.
How long have you been in Carleton?
2 years. So I really value all this. I love the sense of community. I'm really lucky about the department I have. I love having French. Let people as my good friends, instead of, you know, the only people I get to meet are the engineers and the chemists because they're the two buildings next to me, you know. So I love all that. I love having a broad perspective. So it's not all complaint. I just want to handle the Harvard stuff. So those are my leading comments, and guess not.
Okay, are there any specific reactions to...
Yeah, 80% is too high.
Okay, that makes sense.
That's what the institution determines.
Right.
Okay, that's not negotiable.
No, it's not.
I think that 80% you're including not just space time, but also...
Well, right, yeah, I'm talking about prep time and advising time, and, you know, I'm just talking about anything not research time.
how much time it takes to prepare and so forth.
Right. No, face time is, like I said, two classes. It's not officially not all that bad. It's just you got to do a damn good job because they really expect. Carlton thinks it's one of the best colleges.
I can make a comment about that, about the quality of teaching expected at Carlton or Oberlin, which is that. One time we hired a visiting faculty member, we at Oberlin hired a visiting faculty member from MIT, someone who had actually been an Oberlin College graduate, and she was thinking of getting out of her rat race and changing to work at Oberlin College. And when we got letters of reference from MIT, they all said, best teacher in the department, wonderful with students, consistently is rated in the top 5% of MIT faculty, and when she taught at Oberlin College, it was the comments that came back, worst teacher I've ever had, consistently in the bottom 10%, the difference in teaching expectations between a research university and a teaching-oriented college are just extreme.
Actually, I think teaching learning is negotiable. And I think one service this conference can do is send a message to undergraduate institutions that one of the most devastating things they can do to young faculty members, new hires, is to give them a full teaching load their first few years. When a new faculty member is hired, that's when they have their best connections with collaborators. That's when they're right on top of their field. That's the time they really need to establish a research program. It's also the time when they need to learn how to teach. If you give them a full teaching load, they'll devote all of their time to learning how to teach. And a couple of years later, they'll suddenly realize that their collaborations are not as strong as they were initially, and that their knowledge of their field is 2 years old. I'm speaking from experience of 30 years department chair in a research active department.
Just like to second a couple of these things. I've been at Hamilton 3 years now. Now on sabbatical. I will say that the local department atmosphere makes a big difference in terms of support for learning how to teach. And also in terms of distributing loads. Now I carry a full load, it would be 5 courses over the 2-semester year. However, in that first year, they were chosen with great care. And so my preparation time was quite low. In fact, it was absolutely beautiful because I was actually able to carry on some research that first year. Now later in my third year, I discovered that one can be assigned loads and have a semester where I had about 3 or 4 collaborations, new projects started from a previous semester, sort of a leave of absence, and lo and behold, I returned to Hamilton and discovered, no way, there are some semesters where it's simply impossible to do any research whatsoever. And so it varies, and it's really critically important that I think the department the institution is helpful, especially in the beginning, to distribute those loads so it isn't a complete, doesn't completely swamp your time.
I have a question to the chairs who might be here other than you, and that is, if the teaching load is negotiable, then who puts the constraints on the teaching load? The question is, there is a hierarchy that goes beyond the chairs, and so the deans have a say in this, and the deans don't think so much in terms of publications, but in terms of dollar signs that this translates into. And so if you negotiate that you have a higher research component, then it seems to me that this only works if you can translate this into dollars. And that means, as somebody else mentioned, that you follow the funding. And general relativity probably is a hard field to get bucks in at an undergraduate institution. And so my question is, what are actually the constraints, for example, when you say that? Is this view that I just described correct, or is there some leeway or some sort of room that the chair, him or herself, has?
I think that's institutionally based. My institution, the dean, has a very proactive attitude, and any of his new science hires, he can't change the teaching mode, so we don't have release for the junior faculty, but we have, as you said, the very creative course selection. And so when I'm making teaching assignments, and I'm not a chair, but I've just become a person who does teaching assignments because everybody's happy with that. And I sit and watch the event, and I make sure his teaching mode is the lightest in terms of prep time that I can, with teaching courses with someone else when we have multiple sections, so that he has a senior faculty member to help him through. And so we do that, and we take care of each other in that sense, but the dean knows what's going on. And the dean knows that we're trying to do that. So he doesn't micromanage at the level of saying, this person's teaching too light of a load, or if for some reason somebody gets a light load that semester in terms of one course off, it's always the new guy. And the dean is very supportive of that. And if we say, well, we were trying to do this to protect this person because they need to get their research going, he supports it. I'm sure there are other institutions that don't. The dean isn't as supportive, and he's not looking at, did this person bring in money? Or they may be. Ours does not. Ours wants, knows that, he, first of all, they can't bring in money if they don't have time to do the research. And so he lets us do things to try and make sure we can get our new faculty funded as quickly as possible, make sure that their publications keep going, because they came in from a postdoc, and if you don't give them time to finish the publications from the postdoc, they're not going to keep publishing. So he watches that and allows us to do what we need. I'm sure there are places that he's not nearly as supportive of that.
It's almost the same as Kathy said at Smith College. So we are supposed to teach two courses each semester, so 2+2 load, and the dean knows how many courses and we can cover. And then it's up to the department, what do we do? So we do similar things as in Hope College. So for example, if we are going to develop a new course and if we can put a person to develop the course, then it would be the new guy who will be developing the course, although practically he will not be doing it, but the department will help.
Don, did you want to go?
I think, as Kathy said, it's very institution dependent. We don't really have a lot of flexibility teaching load. I'm sure like a lot of departments, you know, we're still overstaffed right at a limit. So you reduce the teaching load, the dean's got to appoint someone to replace. But the dean also has no participation in course selection. But one of the things that we've done is, I'm sure many of you have a situation where you have certain courses offered every other year. And we have a new hire this year. He made sure that he got all courses, A, that he wanted, but he's not a theoretician, so he's got to set up his lab and all that. A, that he wanted, and B, that are offered annually. So that whatever course prep time he does this year, he's not going to be ramping through with a set of new courses next year. And I hope his next year is better than this year, frankly. You know, it's hard.
I was just going to point out that there's a spectrum in the teaching load among our institutions. At the one extreme, maybe the example of my institution, the CSU system, where you're essentially required 15 units of work every semester, 12 of which should be contact hours teaching. Now, I take two courses per semester to mean something like 6 or 8 contact hours. Is this right? Okay. This number is 12 at Cal State. On the other hand, I'm sure we have institutions here where the teaching load may be smaller than 2 per semester. Some of the smaller liberal arts colleges where a lot of attention is paid to research. So, I think it's useful to bear in mind that there's quite a spectrum of teaching hours among us. I found in my experience, and I've been successful in securing some internal release time, basically down to 8 for about 15 years now, that even when I do that with all that teaching, I tend to get pulled back toward the teaching. Even when I'm allocated, let's say 70% and 30%, somehow all those decisions where am I going to do this or the other, almost invariably I follow the teaching side because of the environment that I'm in, because of the ambience, the expectations of the students, and so on and so forth. So please bear in mind that there's quite a range among us.
Can I just check on the factual content of that? Is there anyone here that works at an institution where the teaching expectation is smaller than 2 courses per semester or 4 courses per year, which might, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, it's nominally 2 courses per semester, but if the course is large with a lab, it can count as 2 courses.
Same here.
Can I make a suggestion in that respect? I was very interested in that when you started speaking, 6 people at the same time jumped and said how many hours you teach, which tells you something. It tells you that that's one of the big concerns that we all have. But it tells me something else. It tells me that this is an area where this conference can play an interesting role. Because, see, let me give you my particular taste, but I believe there are some that might be different. We have a new president who said we want to strive for excellence. We want to become, like he said, of course, William Smith. He mentioned the sort of undergraduate colleges of great prestige, etc. It would help me a lot, but I think most of us would be very interested in having concrete data. So my proposal would be not just making formal polls, and I'm willing to work on this with a couple of you. Develop a good questionnaire that we can do this afternoon, tomorrow, whenever, that we all feel with a lot of information, exactly how many hours each of us teaches, exactly what is the equivalence if you teach a lab, many of the conditions, how many faculty members versus how many students you have, how many majors you produce. A lot of information that can help us go to people and say, these colleges that you strive for have this. This situation is like that. And sometimes we manage, and you know, it's typical, I have seen it. When I contact a colleague, the first topic of conversation is precisely that. How much do you teach and why and blah, blah, blah. So perhaps if we have more data, data that is more precise, but it's to the good level. So number of courses, number of semesters, you can imagine that there's a lot of things we can.
Does anyone want to, I take it you're thinking of doing that this week, right?
Yeah. So develop a questionnaire and have it filled out by everybody and tabulate information.
It's a president.
Anyone else who wants to contribute to this fine outstanding effort?
But this is an excellent idea, but it has to be done consistently. I think part of the strategy is always to think in terms of credit hours, which I'm not interested in. I'm interested in contact hours.
Contact hours, number of students, of course.
Why don't you join this committee?
Do you want to participate?
Okay, I think if we can over lunch arrange when we meet and do
it. I would also like to point out that the Council on Undergraduate Research has already tabulated a lot of this kind of information. It may not be in exactly the form that you're after.
But here in a small group, we can go deeper and get more information. And I want to make another comment on some of the things that were said here. I agree with what somebody was pointing out, particularly people who are a little more senior in the institutions. I am also sort of chairman of my department. We can play a lot with the amount of teaching load we can give to junior faculty, even if we have a very strict set of rules by the deans or whoever is on top, simply by playing with the selection of courses, as you have pointed out. There are courses that are more massive that require more time for the faculty member to deal with students, and courses that are less massive, courses that require more or less preparation, etc. That can help. In my institution, for example, we were successful in convincing the provost that junior faculty should have officially a reduced teaching load for the first 3 or 4 years till they get established. And we are fighting, and since we started 3 or 4 years ago, we are now in the fight of keeping it permanently. So actually, that faculty that are hired now come at a reduced teaching load. We used to have 12 contact hours, the new faculty have 8 or 9, and that is helping. I believe that in a generation, probably or less, everybody will have that. Already 1/3 of our colleagues have that, and it's propagating quickly. So that's a strategy that works. The other comment I wanted to make is one thing that you said immediately that you missed a lot is the lack of talks. And that's one of the things people complain in small institutions, that there are not enough talks. We had a very interesting experience that I am willing to share with you of organizing this year a colloquium, and which was very successful. For years we wanted, and sometimes somebody comes and we had a talk. I mean, this is done, I'm sure most of you do it. I said, let's have a colloquium, and people can think, well, we are so few, we are 4 or 5 of us, who will come? We don't have the strength to do it. And actually, it was surprising, since one of the things that happens in small institutions that there are not that many departmental colloquia, as soon as I launched the idea, the people who don't have a colloquium in their departments immediately were with us. I mean, the chemists and the biologists were interested in at least listening to something. And we could very easily get a critical mass and this runs. And this is now an official staple of us. And we're having colloquium. And it was 5 people that were decided to say, we will have it. We will say that we will come. If we cannot start once a week, we'll start once every other week. And that was done. So it is possible to actually, in a small setting, even with small departments, have a regular colloquium. The experience worked very well for us.
Okay, can I? Noah is supposed to be our second.
Yes, okay. Noah.
Can I think there's one more item that might go in this questionnaire?
Yeah.
I'd be interested in knowing. That is whether the teaching load requirements are uniform across the campus. Whether because we could, I can envision a situation with respect to our gambling where the other divisions feel underprivileged with respect to what tactics would be used to address that sort of problem.
Okay, let's.
several of the things I would first raise that we've hit already. I guess I would just list a couple of positive and negative things that I would raise as being significant to me. I would definitely echo, in a positive sense, the choice of field. On the one hand, it's true it's difficult to choose a field that's that is moving every second, but the advantage, and for somebody with a temperament like me who likes these kind of problems, the ability to choose a field that is not dictated upon you by the current way of thinking, I think, is a great advantage. Another thing that I think of as valuable to me, or as an important thing to me, is I sort of look at myself as somebody who does theoretical physics in a field that's never going to cure cancer or build a better mousetrap, and I feel good about having some role of teaching. I think it actually fits in very naturally with somebody who studies sort of basic questions like me, that, if somebody off the street in society says, why should society support this activity? I like to feel like, well, I'm not gonna cure cancer, but I am thinking about difficult problems, thinking about new ways to solve difficult problems that might be applicable in other areas. And what good is that if I'm not communicating that to someone else, to other people, and sort of feeding that back into someone else who may learn the way of thinking that a theoretical physicist has and apply that to a field. Another thing that's been very positive for me is something that's been mentioned is the idea of department support. So as regards teaching load and things like that, knowing that the department is on your side, there are constraints that are much stiffer, but the feeling that I can, that the department is on my side, is trying to make the best of those constraints, is trying to put me in the best position. There are many department meetings where there's sort of something bad comes down the pike, we have to do this extra thing, or we have one fewer person available. And an attitude that my colleagues have that is really very helpful to me and are really tremendously appreciated is, well, I have tenure, my colleagues say, so I'll take the bullet for this one because I have tenure and we'll deal with it. And that's something really that's essential, and I'm really very, very thankful for that. And I think that's, you know, there are these immovable constraints, but it gives me a good feeling, even when I'm overburdened with work, that at least I, you know, we're making the best of the situation, and you know, that the things that I should be worried about, the things that I'm hearing here, I am able to communicate back. I guess I would on the sort of negative side of things, the dark side of these issues, I guess for me the time issue is significant. I have this naive hope that things will take less time in the future now that I have a really killer set of slides for first year electricity and magnetism. I wanted to make it again. Eventually, I'll have a lot more time, so I have that hope. And it is certainly the case that you know, one thing that departments can do is to set that kind of thing up. I will be teaching the same course again next year. One thing that is almost as significant to me than as just time is sort of more drain. A student who comes in a half hour between two classes and asks a question about a fun topic in quantum mechanics and I can go up on the board and talk about it and is interested and takes up some time that I wouldn't really get much done anyway, a little block of time, is much less, you know, I don't put that in the same category as spending that half hour slogging through grading a midterm and trying to decide how many points to give this person or where they went wrong. So I would also put the sort of drain factor along with the time factor for me. That's something that I noticed that I, you know, there's some things, some of each of those that can be cut down or increased. I guess one thing that I might suggest to the more senior people, you mentioned the contrast between MIT and Oberlin. I came from, as a grad student at MIT, and Middlebury has a similar contrast in its attitude towards teaching. I do think, and this is something very hard for a junior faculty member, I think, to promote or to say, is there a continuum. There is an both extremes are, I think, can be problematic in that, you know, MIT has a sort of, they have a neglected students just out of laziness or not being interested. But I think there is also a case to be made that you can have too much attention to your students. You know, I just, as a father of a young child, you know, sometimes he's just got to do it for himself, you know, and I find that kind of a point of view, you know, I'm a little hesitant to say that because it's used as an excuse for so much bad teaching that I don't want to sort of advocate that point of view, but sometimes I feel like, you know, this student, you know, I'm happy to help the student, but maybe the student would be better off feeling a little bit more, just, you know, doing a little bit more on their own, but like I said, there's a continuum. It's certainly not good just to send the students home with a book and let them, you know, learn on their own. They can do that for a lot less money by themselves. And I guess the last thing I would mention as a difficult thing for me to deal with is sometimes when I hear something from my department chair, who, like I said, is extremely supportive of me, so he's really trying to give me the best possible advice that he can, but will say something like, well, it's really great for the students and for the department that you're doing X, where X is supervising an independent study or, you know, taking on an extra thesis student. It's really great that you're doing X, but you better stop because you're not going to get any credit for it, and, you know, this is not in your best interest. And that kind of thing is really hard for me to deal with because I can understand if the department chair says, look, you got to spend more time on this because this is good for the department, even though it's something you don't want to do. But when it's something that he realizes is good for the department and the students realize is good and, you know, it's something that is wanted, but it does fulfill the mission of the college, but is sometimes difficult to communicate to people outside that this is really a helpful thing. And that's probably the hardest single thing that I've had to run into is thinking in that double mode, not just kind of going ahead and doing what I think is a good thing to do, but is this what somebody else would think is a good thing to do? So that's enough.
I want to make one comment upon what Noah said. That last thing that Noah said really struck me, but I don't think that that's a problem at undergraduate institutions. I think that it goes across the board, not only all academic institutions, but all non-academic institutions as well. Certainly it works in politics. You were going to make a comment.
One of the things I think that was common in both of these, and it's humorous because my department chair is actually at a conference for first new faculty coming into undergraduate institutions just in general today, and he was telling me about his theme of his talk is going to be basically three words, and it's how to do research at an undergraduate institution. and his three words that he's going to say over and over during his talk is time on task. The thing he is fabulous at, and that I am not anywhere nearly as good at, is setting aside a time that he is going to do his research and sticking to it. I'm terrible at that. I'm okay if I can get an entire day free with no teaching to say, okay, Thursday's my research day, and now after 9 or 10 years, I don't remember how long I've been there, I'm actually getting pretty good at that. But the first 4 years, it was always, well, Thursday's my research day, but Thursday morning, you know, if I just did this to finish up what I was doing yesterday, then Friday's lecture would be there. And the next thing I knew, Thursday was gone. And I hadn't done any research. He is so good at Thursday's my research day, and that's it. It's my research day. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to do research. The other thing that I think helps him to some degree is he's an experimental type. They have this lab. So on Thursday, they go in, they read their email, then they go to their lab. And students, we have no official office hours. I mean, we do, but students are free to come and go as they please. But the one thing students respect very much is they tend to know that most of the faculty either have Tuesday or Thursday as their research day. And so if they know that that's your research day, they stay away. They occasionally will come and apologize. I know it's your research day, but I'm really busy, and this is the only time I can come see you. And so they actually apologize before and not too many do it. They really don't come. And so that's his research day, and he does it. And he says he will always make progress as long as you can put time on task. And the hardest part as a new faculty for me was, you know, like I said, I have just this much time. You know, and he actually doesn't always have one day free. But he knows that at 3 o'clock, from 3 to 5, he's going to start doing research. And he just does. And if a student comes by, unless it's really important, we ask them to come back at a different time. And they don't mind. They do. But it's really hard for you to do that. It is, especially, first of all, I mean, this is why you're there, because you love working with your students, right? And so it's okay, I'll answer your question. And that's, you know, you spend an hour doing your... And the other thing that in fact, I've gotten better at, is this independence thing. If you have an introductory course, one of the things that we started doing with them, we want them to start thinking for themselves a little bit. And so they're notorious for coming and saying, well, I can't get number 4 right. Okay, well, what have you done? Well, and they have these little notes. He had this good idea, which we've all now stolen. He hands them a 3-ring binder with 50 sheets or so of scratch paper. Basically, we take all the recycled paper out of that looks like glue, and he punched holes in it. And his entire class, the intro course has somewhere between 40 and 60 students in it. He just handed one to everyone on the first day of class. They're not allowed to come to him for help on a problem unless they've started on one sheet of paper, problem 4 is there, and it's gotta have a picture, and they're set up there. And you come to his office, and you show him a scratch piece of paper, and he says, go away. Come back when you have written it out and logically done your best to try and convey what you're thinking that's not working, and then I will help you figure out what's wrong with your process. And he says his office hours are so much more pleasant. And he said, you know, what did it cost us to buy that many notebooks? Okay, it gets buried in the departmental fees anyway. And it didn't cost anything in the grand scheme of things, but it's saving him a lot of time. The students just don't bother to go to him until they write something down, and now your time is much more efficient. What helps is that we have senior faculty doing these types of things so that when the new guy started this fall, we can say, he's doing this, and you're teaching with him. Do the same things, and if they complain, you say, but this is how it's done, and they don't know better, and you can't get in trouble for it. If we stuff him in upper-level courses where you occasionally, I co-taught a course with him, and it was like, okay, we're going to have an unpleasant interaction with a student over this, let me do it. I'll be the bad guy. I'm always the bad guy. Don't worry about it. They think I'm really nasty and mean on my grading schemes. I'll get them angry with me. And so we do. We bite the bullet for each other and do things like that. But things that you've got to budget. You've got to be strict with the students in certain aspects. But then you can also be very flexible about how to do things. Now, for me, what I ended up doing to get my occasional time with students not bugging me is I just closed my office door. Because my lab is my computer terminal sitting on my desk, and so there's no easy way around that. So I just close my door. And students seldom knock. They really don't. So when it's officially research time and I don't want to be bothered, I just shut my door. And I'm getting better at it. I still have this habit of saying, I just did this little tweaking of this slide. Okay. But I'm getting better at it. And it was before I had tenure, but certainly not long before I had tenure. I just said, okay, I stopped caring about or working on those lectures for 4 hours of preparing tomorrow's lecture. It's not gonna, it's not, they're not gonna learn more if I spend 4 hours or if I spend one.
I've got a question for Noah, for Jindu and the other new faculty here, and also a comment. The question is whether you feel there's pressure to do research with undergraduates in particular versus just doing research. And I'd love to hear the terms of people. The comment is, I think a lot of us when we came out of grad school, which for me is closing in on 20 years ago, not quite yet. you know, as a TA, you have that time, you interact with students, it's wonderful, they don't get to talk to professors, and then you show up to this liberal arts college a few years later, you've done a postdoc or something, and you're very eager to please. And you feel that when they come to you and want to talk to you, well, you want it just the same way it was in your TA. And one of the things is that I learned to do is you want the students to have that positive rapport with you, at the same time you want to mark out your own time. So when the student comes up to me after class and say, can I talk to you about this afternoon? And I'll say, well, this afternoon's not good. When are you free in the next couple of days? They tell me their times, and then I pick out of those what's going to work for me. So I don't start off by telling them, well, I'm free only this time, that time, and that time. And that slight change makes a huge difference to the students. They feel consulted, and from the perspective, you know, when they write their letters that are going, what's going to your tenure files, I'm sure that's a lot of it, you know, worried. All the students say, I'm always sending them away. You're not sending them away at all. So those little strategies, I think, can be very valuable. But anyway, I'm curious about this question of what kind of research counts.
And I'd love to respond. And also, this echoes something that was said before, and that is that if one involves undergraduates in research that you're actually involved in, and is not sort of a sideline, then they, when they knock on your door, then they're taking your time away from something else that you might be doing and actually will focus on research. And so on a few occasions I've had tremendous success with this. So I've worked with students over the summer, and then at Hamilton there's a senior project, which is a required thing for all majors in the fall semester. And so therefore that research just continues. And I found that to be spectacularly successful in a couple of cases. So that's been very, very helpful. And then to directly respond to your question, Hamilton is going through a tough time, I think, figuring this one out. There's essentially an unwritten rule that you must work with undergraduates in research for tenure. But if you directly press the senior administration over and over on this, since it's written nowhere, they say, well, no, it's not required. No. But in every other indication from, you know, third year reappointment letters, from so on and so forth, it's clear that in the sciences and mathematics, this is what they're really trying to push. So there's this imbalance that actually really must be addressed institutionally, I think, at some point. And for young faculty, it's terrifying, because you think, well, does that mean I choose a field that for the next 5 years I know that I'll be able to involve undergraduates in because it involves, say, special relativity or something, which undergraduates are more or less familiar with? Or does it mean that I want to pursue this direction because I know that this is the most exciting area that I see at the moment, and maybe it involves some sort of mathematics or whatever background the students just simply don't have access to? So it's delicate. It's a tough one.
Who's pushing this?
It's a long story, but essentially there are departments on campus that tell their young faculty, you must work with undergraduates. In fact, we'll have pinned numbers to this. So more is better before you come up for a tenure decision, or else this department will not recommend you for tenure. So then there are other departments which say, well, it's a good idea, and then there's still other departments which seem to have no line whatsoever. Meanwhile, at the upper levels, so in these sort of reappointment letters and so forth, it's strongly encouraged. But yet there's no formal requirement, because of course they can't do that across all fields.
So the chairs like it, the deans like it, the president likes it, who likes it?
Really? So deans, some chairs, and of course, you know, a variety of faculty members. The president is sort of a little barbed.
Guys, the last 10 years at Illinois State University, it was really almost a policy that we hired only those faculty where we can imagine that they can involve undergraduate research work. In fact, they are specifically screened under that very strict criterion. and we ask them in the interviews how they can imagine involving undergraduates if they have already a track record of having done it. And we simply don't hire somebody who will, where it is clear that undergraduates cannot be involved, period. So in all places, it's really almost a rule.
Yeah, I'd like to say too that in my own institution, it's been a long, hard road to get the administration to recognize that basic research itself is something that we should be pursuing, because the college cites the absence of research as one of the one of the prominent characteristics in this So it's still an issue that we have to deal with, and only recently has it really become possible to pursue research without undergraduate participation.
Now, also at Mount Holyoke, it's assumed that undergraduates will be involved, and that almost always means that when we hire experimentalists, because experimentalists can easily involve students and theorists for all the reasons said, often have trouble.
Yeah, at Occidental, we have all of these things, sort of the unwritten rule, and we don't hire unless we think that they can involve research. Where things get difficult for us, and I'm sure it's the same for many of you, is there is this expectation, especially during the summer, to get research students involved, undergraduates obviously involved. And we have money that anybody on campus can compete for to support that, but it's almost all in the sciences. And yes, we mostly hire experimentalists, it's the same sort of thing. But where it really gets difficult at times is some people very much resent this expectation, because it certainly takes time and effort away from some areas and types of research we would want to be doing, yet get no credit for it. So there's this whole issue of equity across campus for teaching credit, and how much service are you putting in, and how much service are you putting in. And you know, on certain parts of campus, generally fields that don't begin with an SC, so many people disappear in the summer. And yet we're expected to involve these students in the summer and have all the duties during the school year, and there's a certain degree of resentment that we're trying to deal with.
Of course, involvement of engagement of undergraduates in research at small colleges is very attractive to administrations, because it's a great thing for your admissions department to be able to sell. It's a great thing to sell to donors. It really improves the ratings of the college, and for these reasons, administrations really don't want people doing research in the sciences unless they engage undergraduates. At our institution, in physics, chemistry, and biology, we get a 25% reduction in teaching load if we engage students in research in a sustainable research program with publications and peer-reviewed journals and external funding. The external funding can be very sporadic, and the publications and peer-reviewed journals can be as sporadic as you'd expect at a primarily teaching institution. These are ingredients they measure, and they pay us back with a 25% reduction, which answers you can, if you want to, not do that, choose not to do that, and go away and do your own research, but you're going to teach 33% more.
But this is not a buyout, you're saying, right? This is not something that you buy with your grant.
I've gone 3 years without a grant, without external support. And that, as long as I was writing grants and that sort of thing, and then I got a grant. I said, oh yeah, we're glad we came.
Heidi.
Hi. I was just going to say, I also was hired on the premise that I would do research with undergraduates. When I was hired, we only had undergraduates. I've been teaching now for 12, 13 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. I feel every year a bit. But at first, I really couldn't see how I was going to do lazy without inversion and weird stuff with lasers with a bunch of undergraduates whose mathematical skills were left much to be desired. So I ended up just asking the students, hey, what do you want to do research on? And quite often it was an experimental project. So they basically expected me to do experiments with them, which I did. I did a robotics experiments. I did stuff on green flash and all kinds of weird stuff. I did that for a few years. Then I got tenure, and I spent for this. Research over the summer. That's any time I get to do my own research. So I would work during the semester, and I'd take 5-6 students on at a time, and I would do my three courses and my 3 units of whatever committee work and just to make up my 15 total units. So three courses and like you said, it's 15 units at the Cal State system. And then expect you to take on students as well. Unfortunately, we didn't get credit for the students we take on, unfortunately. I think you should really get credit, but you really don't at Cal State.
I want to make a suggestion for this survey that there be something on the order of, do you get teaching credit for taking on students? Yes.
Okay, I'd just like to offer an anecdote by way of counterexample to the idea that experimenters find it easier to engage undergraduates. 5 years ago, we made the most recent hire in my department of someone who was an experimenter out of Purdue in solid state physics. And times were tough in my university and there was no money to offer that person a startup laboratory. So that person made a career change and became a computational physicist, dealing with solid state issues from a computational perspective, and got undergraduates involved in research because the faculty member was doing the mathematically sophisticated stuff, and there was a great deal to do that involved just writing computer code. Okay? And our undergraduates, believe it or not, folks, by the time they're juniors, are experts in C++. So we can give them a project and they can run with it on their own. And that has been very successful. That person got tenured this spring.
Yeah, I just wonder, you know, what do we really call undergraduate research participation? Mm-hmm. What is the purpose of it? In my opinion, the purpose is to teach the students what research is all about. So does it have to be a publishable research? I would say no, not necessarily. There are so many things students can do with us, little pieces of the work that we do, and they get the experience. I think it, we should think about it.
I want to run with that, and that one of the points you made was that you have a lot more freedom as at a predominantly undergraduate institution. That's something that, yes, if you have a graduate student, you have to give him a relatively, him or her, a project that's relatively likely to succeed within the next amount of time, or else you have killed that person's career. Not true with undergraduates. I mean, undergraduates aren't supposed to publish.
Right.
So you can give that person a very high-risk project that has a very small chance of succeeding. But if it does succeed, it will succeed spectacularly. That has actually happened at our institution, not in not in theory, but in an experiment. One of our students was at an REU program at the Very Large Array, and she was part of the group that detected brown dwarfs, and her work was published in the New York Times.
Yes. So, if you don't mind me picking on you a little, I respectfully disagree with your claim about why we teach undergraduates, well, how engaged am I? I don't think, well, they do learn what it means to do research. You tell them, do this, 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 and then this will happen, and then it doesn't. You go, well, that's research. I don't think they really learn too much about research, except, but I do think they learn a lot about teaching themselves how to do things. And so I think of it more as equally valuable to just formal coursework as just a basic education. I think it's maybe more valuable when they go into the real world. So even if they never really learn how to solve any scientific problem,
it's
more a matter of definitions now. But I think it's not so much research per se as it is the act of just solving problems outside of a classroom setting.
Absolutely. My point was that it does not have to be a publishable research.
Oh, absolutely. I see.
I wanted to both respond to that and the original question. As a junior faculty member, I feel like I have to do two things. One is I have to involve undergraduates in my research. I don't know at what level it is or isn't written in the bylaws, but I've been told I will not get tenure and will not be reappointed unless I do this. I also have to publish. Those don't have to be the same thing, but you have to ask yourself, given all the time constraints and everything else, can I publish on one research front and involve undergraduates on another research front? Suddenly, how am I doing two research fronts?
You should do what is the best for you.
I just want to throw that out. I agree that I think undergraduate research that isn't published is extremely valuable, but I think many of our institutions also expect at least their junior faculty in order to get tenure to also publish research, and these don't have to be exclusive.
Yeah, and just this is pretty much the same thing. There's this implicit, involving undergraduates, part clearly I was screened for it. I know that that was one thing that continually came up in the hiring process. So it's unwritten that you have to involve them. But I'm not necessarily going for or against. I'm just quoting, I think, from Research Corporation or something, reports which say that research, there's a difference between research experience and research. And research experience is sort of a simulacrum of research. It's like you act like you're doing research, but you're not really doing research because it's not going anywhere. And that's what a lot of undergraduate experience turns out to be in this country, where you sort of play in this sandbox here, and don't bug us because we're working on the real thing. And the weight, at least from the funding agencies, is for involving students in the real publishable stuff. I'm not sure what will come of that from my perspective in 5 years, but certainly I know that's the trend, or that's the pressure I have them involved in the real work, the real publishing work, with all the constraints of how do I get them involved, how to publish, etc. In terms of what the actual official research pressure is, I was lucky enough to come with enough things in the air that I've already collected enough. But on the other hand, I have colleagues who publish incredibly hard and well, and well, nothing to do with the official standards of the college. They're way above that. The department is, just blazing its own path through the research plan. So, the pressure is all over the place.
Well, I was just going to mention the type of research that I did. Some of it was publishable, but other stuff like little robot projects and little experiments, I'd make them give a talk, and I'd also make them write it up like a paper. And we do have a little college paper called Dimensions, and it goes. I'd ask them to submit to a college paper. So I think they really were getting a research type experience, even though the research wasn't my research in particular. It was just something that they wanted to do. Oh, and I certainly agree that computation is a very good way to go. Learning some Fortran, some C is never a bad thing.
Okay. About your talks, quick reaction. What about having the students present at the student sessions of AAPT?
Yep, some of our students have done that.
We've had numerous students doing that recently.
I just wanted to pick up on something Margaret said and make sure that it got heard, because you said it very modestly, but do what works for you. I hear, I'm thinking now from a position of eminent wisdom, 25 years of teaching and studying the, watching the situation. Lots of people are commenting on what their dean expects or what their chairman thinks they ought to do or what the rules and where they're written down and stuff like that. And I had a junior colleague a few years ago who agonized constantly over what the institution wants him to do. And he would go to the biology department and they would say, oh, you've got to do a job, you've got to publish 7 papers a year. And then we would go to the French department, and they say, oh, every college publication doesn't mean anything. You don't know. You'll be teaching well, and you would go to other people and get totally contradictory advice, and it was driving him crazy. And I thought, for God's sake, do what you do, and do an excellent job of it. And if Reed College doesn't like it, then you shouldn't want to be here anyhow, But I think it is the kiss of death psychologically. Maybe I'm just unusually arrogant, but my own attitude was, I will do a superb job at what I do, by my standards, the best I can do of what I do, and if the college doesn't like it, that's not for them. They judge only themselves by judging me. My arrogant attitude, and I do think that that afforded a good little psychological protection for me before I got tenure. And the other thing is, I think that it's actually more accurate than dealing with institutions. Institutions don't really, by and large, don't have really well-defined notions of what they want, and different people want different things for different reasons, and some people will lay down all kinds
advice to junior faculty is to take that with a bit of a grain of salt, as I say, just do a hell of a good job of what you can do, and then don't worry about it.
After all, you're the expert that the university or college hired, not the president, certainly, not the dean, almost never, but probably not even your chair.
I want to say something about that, and that institutions, we sort of think that they're sort of solid, but in fact institutions are made up of people. Those people come, those people go, and it's entirely possible that that if you work hard to satisfy the criteria that were established, well, by the time you're evaluated, there'll be different people sitting in those chairs, and you're going to be evaluated by different people anyway. Yes.
My epiphany came at somewhere in my fourth year, where I finally said, I've got to stop trying to do what I think everybody else wants me to do. Mm-hmm. And I've got to realize one of my benchmarks was my husband, who started at the same time. He's an experimentalist. He gets these instrumental grants, you know, and I get my theory grant. And I was really happy with my most recent grant. And 3 weeks later, he got one that was more than a factor of 10 bigger than mine. And so there's always this pressure, and he does that every year. It's and so I always have this pressure of what he can do and how much he can publish every year. And so for those first 4 years, it was really tense watching all these experimentalists come in with these things that were always huge compared to what measly little things I could get. And year four or five, I don't care. I'm going to do what I do best. And my way of publishing, at the beginning, the peer review journal was important, so I made sure I collaborated with experimentalists, and I could get some publications out that way. And then, like I said, I stopped caring. And I made sure that I presented at AAPS meetings, at divisional meetings of the AAPS. I made sure my students went to any undergraduate conference I could send them to so that they were publishing. I now have a student who published in JURP, Journal of Undergraduate Research in Physics. And they're not, well, that actually is peer review. It just doesn't have my name on it, but it still counts. I made sure that everything I did was documented, and I did, if I was really heavy on teaching 1 year, I went to an AAPT meeting and I presented my work that I did, whatever curriculum development stuff I did, and I made sure that that was documented. And I started realizing, I've shown everybody what I am doing well. It's not necessarily always a fit PRC or a PRL, but it's documented, and I felt happy. I'm much happier with my life now. And it's often, I got tenure, even though I didn't do the traditional number of standard peer-reviewed journals. I had my students involved in bits and pieces along the way, and their names were on all the posters and other things, and it worked fine.
Scott, I'd like to second David's comment about do what you want to do and do it well, because I think if you look across our institutions, tenure is made not by some checklist, I would venture to say. No historian I know has ever been denied tenure for not having done research with an undergraduate. And sometimes what I think we need to do as departments is to educate the tenure committees and the deans and the presidents. At least in my institution, I think they're very willing to be educated. They know they don't know. They see biology and chemistry. It's very easy to involve undergraduates in biology and chemistry, right? You know, the kind of work I do, it's not easy. I have published a paper with a student. That was a fortunate circumstance, but I wasn't going to stop working on the issues in supersymmetric field theory that interested me when I arrived just because of some rule. And we had no official expectation, no unwritten expectation. I was the first theorist hired into a tenure-track slot in a long time, so I was in the fortunate position of defining some of the expectations. But one of the things I found later, after I got tenure and then I served on our campus tenure committee, is that the process is not what I thought it was. Now, the process actually, I think, turned out to be really good. I like what the process was. But I would advise all the junior faculty who are here to talk to people who have served on the campus tenure committee, however it works in an institution, and find out what it's really like, what the job really is. You know, and it varies from institution to institution as to how much, say, goes to the department, to the campus-wide committee, to the deans. Learn what that's about, and I think in a large respect, it would take a lot of the pressure off that you might feel about what might happen, because you're imagining all the possible things they might require of you. And probably their imagination is not as vivid as yours.
Yes.
There is too much agreement here, and so let me disagree. Some of these demands are wishful thinking of the means is actually not bad. To do research is not a bad thing. To do research with undergraduates is not a bad thing. To do publishable research with undergraduates is not a bad thing either. And so part of what I understood is why we are here is to learn how we can do that. And so the question is not so much, is it valuable that you do some experiment, some research with undergraduates that is not publishable? That's a given. It's beyond classroom work. It is some problem solving where they don't just regurgitate problems that they know are solvable and problems that they know are solvable in two lines. Anything that goes beyond that is valuable. But that is not the question. The question is whether one can actually do the real thing with undergraduates, perhaps even get some money out of the NSF in some way, and get it published. And that is what I would like to see here.
You had your hand up.
Yeah, me?
Yes. Sorry, I can't remember your
name. It's related to our previous discussion. For several years, I served on the College Committee on Tenure and Promotion. So we are getting all these questions, what do I do to get tenure? And there is no answer to it, as they know. So I always used to say, you do your best. And I think that it's a duty, not only the opportunity, but the duty of senior members of the departments to make it clear, to sell the case of junior faculty, to explain that to do research in theoretical physics is not exactly the same as to do research with students in biology.
But if you're the only young theorist in the department, that's kind of...
So you have to educate
right.
your senior colleagues. Yes.
To get off the top of the rank of tenure committees. I wanted to go back to this spot up and what Arjendri, sort of by the beginning, which one thing is how is this my understanding that this conference will somehow help us understand how to help each other, how to support theoretical research in the institution. So I wanted to build on something you said about this quote-unquote, this social activity that physics is, which I agree with totally, because I always think it's ironic that people think the social, topics are in English and poetry and stuff. It's the exact opposite, right? The poet goes in the hides.
Goes down a blackboard.
Physicists can't imagine, I mean, at least, especially today, maybe 300 years ago or something, sitting alone in some little place writing their little equations, and it just doesn't work that way. There's conversation that happens. There's all kinds of things that go on and then they develop. That's why I think teaching ends up sucking so much of our time, because it's obviously a very social activity too. And when you're isolated in a smaller institution, which I don't know the size of all the departments here, that's another interesting statistic, what's the size of the department? Because no one overlaps with me in my department, and I assume that's the same with most people. So you have the social activity going on, and what's going to drive you? You got some student showing up at your door, you got a bunch of students showing up in a room somewhere, you're going to be drawn toward that, because it's there, the interaction's there. Whereas when you're sitting down to do your research, you're isolated, you're alone, you think, oh, I can't do it now. You need someone to talk with about it. And so I wonder if there's some, that, just to bring it back to that, I'm just wondering that, how that can be done within, this is again a difficult thing because you're still isolated by geography, but is there a way to start developing methods and techniques and ways and communities that can support each other in some regular way on the research aspect of it to keep that? So that can be on the forefront because it's not day to day and it's the students that are there, it's not the research colleagues there.
All right, I wanted to say exactly along that line. We have a half an hour left in this session, and one of the big things that you raised at the beginning was the lack of talks and the lack of
collaborations, and it's hard to do over the internet. I mean, it's very hard to gesture on the so I would indeed like to say more about that.
Along the same lines, the one thing that's been a kind of a nice change recently is there's a every fall the group of nuclear theorists in the Midwest get together and have a meeting at Argonne, and so it's really nice to be able to do that. The thing that I find that's actually kind of frustrating for me is that it started so late after I stopped doing research in a big institution that I actually feel like I'm so far on the periphery that I'm not getting a lot from this meeting anymore. But that might be a mechanism to have some sort of formal way of having these regional meetings, even if they're only once a year, that you could go to and, you know, and it's, it has to start soon, so correct for you, that before you feel like you're so isolated and far from the edge of the field that you don't really feel like you're on pay, it might help. One thing that's going to be hard here is we all, there are generalologists, a huge group of folks doing what they are doing. I only know of two other people that use the word nuclear. So this is not going to be a great meeting for me to find someone who's hot in the field of nuclear theory that I'm working in. But then again, I'm so far from the edge that I'm willing to change. So I mean, but one of the things that might be helpful is to have regional gatherings and find places other besides just the NSF or this institution to host them and put them together and pay for them. If we find a way of getting those regional meetings going, that might be one way to help young faculty stay active.
The American Physical Society does have the possibility of having divisions, sectional divisions. And there's a New England section, and there's an Ohio section, which is soon to become the Ohio-Michigan section.
Yes, I was coordinating that.
it's not exactly what you've been talking about, but one of the things that I particularly found, particularly when my kids were real young, was that I just could not get up and go to a marching meeting of the American Physical Society. But there were these little bitty meetings of the Ohio section of the American Physical Society that were nearby. I think it would be a good thing if there were more sections of the sections of the American Physical Society for a number of reasons. And maybe later on we could make that as a formal recommendation, although I don't know that anyone has ever gone to listen to it. The people right behind me, I hardly ever look for hands right behind me. Can I just say anything?
Gary came in, maybe Gary could introduce yourself.
Gary Bowman. I don't know how much of an introduction you want.
Where you are, what you work on.
Northern Arizona University, and I guess the best description is my main interest is foundations of quantum mechanics, and I'm always hesitant to say I'm interested in Bohm's theory because people figure you're kind of out left field. I don't necessarily think it's true, but I am interested in it.
I was going to say that, but then I said, if I send back, everyone will think he's off and left field.
Yeah. So. I'll make one comment if I can, if I can kind of jump back to where we were 10 minutes ago. I know we're talking about meetings and that sort of thing, but on the subject of undergraduate research, I hope somebody didn't say this before I came in. I just flew in this morning. But it seems to me that I don't know the lady's name across the table, but she was saying that she got to a point where she finally just said, look, I'm going to do what's right for me.
No, goes at that.
Yeah, I think the lady next to you. That I'm thinking of, at any rate. I mean, where I am, I see people who are experimentalists, and they'll involve 3, 4, 5 students continuously. And I used to kind of have this inferiority complex, like, gee whiz, you know, how am I going to do that? And I kind of realized finally that I don't have to do that. And my point really is that I think that's a case possibly for us to make to schools, is that, not to beat up on our experimentalist friends, but we may not involve as many students, but arguably we involve them possibly in a more substantial way. I mean, you'd have to make the argument rather delicately. But I think it's true in this case. I mean, I've seen students involved in experimental research who, to maybe caricature it a little bit, their research involves go get me a 9/16 bolt today's hardware, and that's, you know, hopefully generally amounts to more than that. But I think theorists can make an argument that we involve students in a very substantial way, but maybe can't involve the same quantity of students that experimentalists. That's all I
can say. Just on ideas in terms of, just to pick up on this idea of regional meetings and so forth. So sort of three things that have occurred to me, and a couple of them, and One is postdocs at some institutions, at a number of these type of institutions, the startup funds are given, and sometimes those are enough, perhaps with some supplementary funds to put together a postdoc. FAB is a thing to do, because then you can have at least a research group of two. Another is visitors, and this is where I see a great place for external funding, actually. And it just so happened that I had somebody come last summer and visit for a couple of months. It worked out fabulously, simply because, again, there was a little bit of an activity in my own, I mean, we're collaborators. But not only that, the students, and not just students working directly with me, but other students, started sort of revolving around this person in the sense of, you know, asking them physics questions, doing little side problems and that sort of thing. And that suddenly, I mean, it was amazing. There was a little group, not that it was, you know, not that it lasted very long, but it was an interesting sort of happenstance. I'd love to see more visitors come through and that sort of thing. And so those are just some ideas. Oh, I guess the third was to go elsewhere, right? So, of course, if possible, to have short leaves at other places like ITP or places like this where you can sort of jump into the real boiling ferment of ideas and research and sort of get restarted.
Was there a hand back here?
Yeah, I was just going to say, as far as conferences go, I mean, there are at least some conferences that are particularly keen to engage people from undergraduate institutions. So I know, for example, for the Gordon conference this year in particle theory, I was recruited to go to it. Unfortunately, it's going on this week. But one of the organizers was particularly keen to have people from undergraduate institutions attending. So
they have pooey funds.
I was going to say they have a specific money to bring people like us.
In principle, the internet too exists, which is, you know, the ITP will broadcast broadband talks. It's extremely expensive for one person to solicit that at a college, you know. So you can go into a little room and get plugged into a talk across the world. This is a very expensive solution.
But the alternatives are perhaps even more expensive.
Right.
Why is it expensive? If talk is streamed on the internet?
Broadband, so that it's both ways. It's extremely expensive to convince a school to go to Internet 2 just because of one theorist who doesn't get enough talks. That's what I mean. I mean, prorated across the entire college is another issue altogether. And the other comment I wanted to make was to echo this undergraduate being recruited to go to places is something we were talking about loosely before we got on the bus. Was we have a selling point, which is our majors are typically good. Is what the grad students want. If we could figure out some kind of horse trading where they would give us stocks in exchange for majors. You know, which one? I'm trying to use that as recruitment.
I just
want to
say that before we got on the bus, he said, would they give us money in exchange?
Okay, sorry.
The bounty, right?
We definitely do that. Right? We have an active, connective colloquium series, and many of the speakers will be people who are hoping to attract graduate students.
Yeah. One of the ways of attracting people there is seeing the possibility of showcasing their product or their private students. That's the calling we have. We have good undergraduates that are very attractive to graduate programs.
I'm always embarrassed to do it because we have no money to pay for them to come and you hear these things, of, you know, these things we're supposed to pay people for honoraria. And then I discover that our chemistry department has a seminar every single week of the semester and every institution is calling them and asking them to let them come and let them pay the whole thing, including the dinners with the students and all that. Once the reputation is there, and so for you it may be local.
Right. Sure.
And so in the physics, for us in physics, it's calling Michigan State, University of Michigan, Notre Dame. They're all willing to pay their own expenses to drive. Now flights are, you know, we haven't gotten brave enough to call places farther away, but if they know your institution and you've ever sent an undergraduate their program, be brave, be daring, call and ask if anyone from that department is willing to come and give a seminar for free. Go on and pay your own travel expenses, but we'll let you come and talk to our students. We'll give you all the opportunities to meet our students and try and steal it.
And therefore, foundation labs have to do it free.
Oh, okay, right. That's right. They're not allowed to pay.
The ethos that has evolved with us is we get people to come for free, like you said, not a plane ticket, but you know, they'll drive from as far away as Purdue, say, or Champaign-Urbana to Chicago or something like that. And we'll give them a great Chicago-style pizza right across the road.
Yeah, I had one comment on the what is seemingly a common denominator that most of institutions encourage or try to encourage research with undergraduates. So this is seemingly now something that is moving in all fronts. What I felt, and that's why I was so interested in your comment, is to find out from most of you if we were clever enough to convince our institutions that that requires time, that that's, if that's something desirable, that requires time, sometimes makes us divide, as you were suggesting, the, our fronts of research, or develop, in my case, I developed this whole computational interest, because in my theoretical part, it's difficult to engage the students, but perhaps in modeling some of the things, they are very useful, and I have successfully used them. Convince institutions that that's something that should be rewarded to some mechanism, that should count towards teaching goals, or that should count. Many institutions would pay for the students to do that. That's normally the case. But do they count that for us? That requires a lot of our time, and time is the thing we like. We lack, most of us. That's what we are saying here. So if there are strategies that work in some places, I would like to hear from those. The other comment was in the with respect to the story of the isolation that sometimes we feel. I wanted to ask the opinion of people here. We are in the process of starting a search now. When we were very hotly debating among the few of us, should we look a lot for a person like us? A person. So there was one of us was saying, well, we are very small. We are not going to cover the whole area of physics. Let's concentrate on have 3-4 condensed matter physicists that work in similar problems, so at least we can do something, and we have some presence, and we are not isolated. And some of you were saying, no, we are too small. We want to expose our students, so let's bring a high-energy person. So let's try to expand the horizon, because if not, our students are not competitive, and we don't get to hear ideas from other fields. And that's a problem. You see, if we have three of us, and the three of us can collaborate, in some sense, we are breaking our isolation. If the three of us are very far away, each one of us in our teams, each one of us is in a different office and doesn't talk to each other and cannot bring visitors, etc. So that's a question that also rises in my mind in small departments, as most of us are, and I would like to hear opinions on that too.
Can I say about that is that the experience of Amherst College is of interest. Some many years ago, before Bob was there, Amherst College decided that they were going to be a low-temperature physics department, and that they were going to hire only low-temperature experimentalists, low-temperature theorists, and then they would have cryostatic equipment, and it would all be hunky-dory because they'd all be able to talk with each other. They bring in visitors, and they're going to become a real center for low-temperature physics. And that worked okay for a while, and then an attractive hire came by who wasn't a low-temperature physicist. And sort of, it requires enormous discipline. We demand, our institutions demand a lot of the faculty members, certainly in my opinion, to be both good researchers and good teachers. And when we get 150 resumes or 300 resumes for one slot, it's very easy to throw 90% of them in the trash can. It's very hard to find a person who's going to be a good match at research. At an institution that purports to be a research institute, a research college rather than a research university, and to throw on top of that the demand that they also be a low temperature person, is going to whittle your number of acceptable candidates to less than zero.
But that doesn't mean one should aim for that, because I believe that that's absolutely the right way to do. You have concentrated focus groups where you can communicate with groups within your university and therefore be maybe the center in that narrow area.
Okay. There are certainly advantages, but it requires a lot of discipline.
Yep.
And Bob, did you want to?
Okay, just to finish the history of that story, the low temperature room completely evaporated a few years ago due to various retirements and so on. The department has, in the meantime, also established a pretty significant presence in AMO physics and has really superb young folks there who joined some of the senior faculty. And we're now sort of reestablishing that. I mean, we face that same quandary with recent hires. I think we're very lucky to find Will, who is interested in, you know, many different areas of theoretical physics, so he, in fact, complements many of the things that are going on. And I think, again, we've evolved to a situation where we've given up this notion of really trying to focus on several groups. If it turns out that a good candidate complements an existing group, fine. If not, we're just going to the strongest person we can get, and we'll figure out how to do things with a broad spectrum of physics representation.
Done. There's also an institutional issue there. Physics and math are unique amongst the disciplines in a liberal arts college in that any of us can essentially teach any of the courses in the curriculum. And if you go over to the history department, they've got someone who does American history, 19th century, right? The chemistry, biology. And I said math and physics were the only ones. And at least at our institution, this is a hard issue. The way positions are allocated, they want to look and say, well, let's see, you know, we can't have a political science department without a political theorist. As opposed to the political science department going in there saying, well, you know, we're going to cluster in political theory here and not represent American politics. Now, we can do this in physics because we can teach all the way across, and I think it's an opportunity maybe not to have all one field, but to have, when the right candidates come along, to take advantage of that. But there is a position, I think, an issue of how one sells that when one is trying to argue for new positions. Because other departments have a great deal of trouble understanding this. I mean, you can sit in the room, you can be on the committees and explaining to them that, yes, we have someone who can teach this course, but you know, we don't have enough people to teach this set of courses. It's a very different mindset.
And there's a problem with education, and some of those people just refuse to be educated.
just to comment, I mean, one advantage of undergraduate colleges or primarily teaching schools is that you sort of get in on your teaching credentials, and you get to do what you want. We sort of talked about this. And so the maverick idea of people will then sort of get even more excluded if they shut out of small schools as well, because their idea is not currently one of the established fields. You know, it's something that the nonlinear dynamics and chaos community has faced. Therefore, I'm speaking sort of from that perspective, which is that the physics department, it exploded in terms of PhDs produced, but the hires didn't happen, except in experimental physics, because they could fake themselves as condensed matter experimentalists or something. And so we've dissipated to math departments, applied math departments, and undergraduate colleges, which is why so many times nonlinear dynamics came up here, I think, which is that it's an attractive field, but it doesn't have the sort of same sort of standard institutional presence as AMO, condensed matter, et cetera. So I would say from the incoming perspective, to feel that even the undergraduate schools are clustering around a specific well-recognized areas would be scary for someone who is in an unusual field.
I find it very unlikely those fields would be theoretical at all.
Exactly.
If the average school instead of going to focus on something, the chance that it's going to be theory.
Right. Or an unusual theory.
Oh, yeah, any kind of theory.
So you feel more pressure to be applied.
Our cluster, at least when I first got the book, was nuclear. Everyone in our department had some tie to nuclear stuff. And so when I showed up, we had the nuclear group, and I was a part of it. My students worked in the same room as all of our nuclear types, and of course, being nuclear accelerator-based researchers, they all had to go elsewhere to do the experiments and then bring the data back. And so their lab really was a bunch of computers and nothing else. So my students fit in. And that helped a lot in the beginning to keep things going, because there was the nuclear group meeting happening every Thursday, and I went to it. My students went to it. They spoke and said what they had done. Our nuclear group is now evaporating because that branch of nuclear experimental work is starting to be passe. Everybody went to RIC and Corpus on plasmas, and our nuclear experimental folks had a hard time staying at the cutting edge there. While I was having a hard time figuring out how to stay at the cutting edge of my stuff, they had the same problem, so the nuclear group had evaporated too. So one of the things when we went to look for our most recent hire, it was, do we hire another nuclear type well, or what? And we were realizing, we actually went to something else. We hired somebody against Maverick because we thought we needed that diversity for the students. But the point of the story was, you may not find another theorist doing what you're doing at your institution, but if you can find any experiment, anybody at your institution that's interested in similar things. For me, another piece of the connection, lately has been talking with my physical chemistry folks, because the physical chemists are the closest people in the chemistry department to thinking like a physicist that I can find. And since I do a lot of numerical modeling stuff, turns out we have a lot of shared interests, and I just didn't know it. So you don't have to have a theory group to necessarily have conversations. You just need other people with similar interests. And that's the hard part of bridging the boundaries, the hard thing. Because when I first got there, the chemistry department and the physics department never spoke and despised each other. The communication actually improved quite a bit when you had one spouse in one department and one in the other. They had to stop bad-mouthing physics in the chemistry department meetings, and they had to stop physics department meetings, and now we actually like each other. I'd be divorced by now, I guess. That helped a lot, but it's hard. It's a hard boundary to break.
We have 10 more minutes, and I wanted to bring up, to return to this idea that was brought up quickly and then passed over about reduced teaching loads for new faculty members, which would of course be good for all disciplines and both theorists and experimentalists. One thing to do would be to simply ask NSF for money. The question is whether or not this is really going to be effective. Hussein, did I get your name right?
Hussein, sorry.
Hussein brought up what I always call the lure of teaching, or the pool of teaching, which is that, you mentioned this also, the teaching is so immediate. 364 days out of the year, the teaching is there. And then on the day that salary review was announced, you said, boy, I should have done more research. But then comes another string of 364 days where teaching is sort of the most immediate thing. It's right in front of you. Research can always be put off. So would this be, would this really be an effective way? If we're able to get our young people and give them reduced teaching loads, would that just mean that they're going to teach more? Great, David.
Well, I have a general comment about this. When we were talking about teaching loads before, and different people saying how many courses they were expected to teach, frankly, I've been through conversations like this often, and the calculus is mystifying to me. We don't have any dean that tells us how many courses you're supposed to teach. The institution doesn't tell us how many courses the department is supposed to teach. We don't have an all-powerful chairman who says, you will do this and you will do that. The department gets together every year and says, well, what should we teach next year? And then we divide it up. And if we've got a new faculty member coming in, we probably say, let's give Don just one course in the fall and let him get his feet on the ground. And by the way, warn him that all of the dead thesis students who are gravitating toward the new faculty. I warned you about that. The guy said, no, I'm going to be perfectly straight, and even if you tell me watch out for so-and-so, I'll treat him like anybody else. And he got several duds, and then a couple of really good ones. What makes me a little nervous when I hear people saying, well, let's go to the dean and argue for reduced loads, for example, or something like this, is my reaction is exactly the opposite. I don't want the dean to think he has a finger in the pie of how we divide up our teaching loads, because maybe this is unusual luxury, but we do it all ourselves, and I desperately want to keep it that way. When people say to me, how many courses do you teach at Reed College? Well, in the French department, they teach two courses one semester and three courses the other semester. Yeah, but how about physics? Well, I couldn't tell you. Some semesters I've taught, colleagues of mine have taught three courses in a given semester. I have not infrequently taught one course in a given semester. This last semester, I taught one course, and it was the heaviest load I ever had. There were 180 students in it, and they said, people in the French department say, well, how many lectures you give? Three lectures a week. Three lectures a week, and that's a full load? Well, there were six conferences I had to go to. Also, I had to organize 12 labs and run a whole stable of student assistants and whatnot. It was one heavy damn load, but it was actually one course on paper. And I don't want the institution saying one course is not enough, you've got to teach two. As I say, maybe my experience is unique, but I get very nervous when people start talking about how we should negotiate with the dean about this or that. I have also one other comment. You were saying, Dan, that NSF may be support. I think for most of us, the departments are small enough that if you've got the NSF to say, well, we'll give you a released load for one person for a quarter time or something, how would we possibly use that money? You can't hire a quarter of a person. So that doesn't strike me as a practical solution in what are typically these small departments.
That gives you a touch of reality. First of all, in many institutions, it's written down what the teaching load is. And it is often an insane...
But how do you count if you're supervising...
It is difficult to count, but it is written down. And the insane number that is often mentioned is 12 credit hours. That can translate into 16, 18 contact hours if you do labs, first of all. Second, the NSF would help tremendously. And the answer to the question of reduced teaching load is definitely yes, because if you get money from the NSF, you can, for example, avoid teaching in the summer. Many people teach in the summer because they say, I just need the money. I have kids that will go to school, and I need the money. And so any dollar that you get from the NSF will help. Third, in many institutions, you have part-timers. Part-timers are being paid dirt. And the money that you get from the NSF more than pays for part-timers. That is the reality for many institutions.
Okay, Hussein has his hand up and also works at an institution with very rich structure. Okay, we'll have time after him.
Yeah, I was going to make a remark complimenting what Griffith said. But before that, NSF has a strict rule of not supporting salary during the academic year, 3 or 4 years. As far as I know, and I heard this essentially on the phone from Forrest Kaiser today, there is no salary support in the release. But yes, your experience is unique in the sense that, again, we have quite a spectrum here. Perhaps my system is the other extreme from yours, the Cal State system, 23 campuses, which is essentially devoted to offering the cheapest education there is on Earth. Certainly in the United States. Just 2 or 3 days ago, they voted to raise the fees by 40%. Even after the raise, it's the cheapest institution in the nation. Now, you're appalled by the conditions where the teaching load issue ties in with the dean or the institution. Cal State system is coupled to the legislature. The politics of it, I don't mean this as an exaggeration. They directly have a say happens because to a very real degree what Cal State does affects the demographics, particularly the minority groups as far as accessibility to free education and so on, nearly free education is concerned. So the politics of the state is very, very directly, intimately connected with this, and the resources are extremely limited. However, having said this, let me now present the other side of this. In recent years, our teaching mode is again fall. It's nominally 15 hours, 3 hours counted as committee work, or perhaps other similar activity, then you're essentially bound to 12 contact hours. That's contact hours, not credit hours. Now, there's a tremendous reaction to this, as you can well imagine, because it's just too much. And in recent years, the system, which prior to, let's say, the early 90s, stipulated every little thing that went on every campus in every department according to a formula, centrally determined, gave some freedom to the campuses. And to make a long story short, that has trickled down to some freedom of scheduling, innovative, creative scheduling, whereby you essentially make a under the table agreement with your dean that, look, this is, these are my teaching units, and I'm going to trade this large class against that small one. You let me teach that one, and I'll make sure that I have enough teaching units coming on this one. So, you're very fortunate. And there are other institutions like yours, and that's very good. But it's, again, I want to all of us to bear in mind that there's a spectrum here, and we have problems of all sorts.
We have come to the end of our time, of course, not to the end of the discussion, but we should have a 10-minute break now, and we will come back to looking back with insight, the perspective of the senior faculty, and David will organize that session.
So, 10 minutes?
Yes, 10 minutes.